calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, quite literally from Pennsylvania to California, beaming down on from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org. AirAmericaRadio.com, and also on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's the last day of the week, the day and the first hour of our program on the last day of the week, the time when we like to devote the first of our 3 hours here to Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in the House of in the history of the House of Representatives, been reelected 7 times from his home state of Vermont. I think of him, however, as America's congressman. He's not a Democrat, not a Republican. He's the only independent member of the House of Representatives. His website, Bernie.org. For more information, Bernie.org. If you'd like to call in and be on the program today with Bernie, have questions, comments, thoughts, whatever it may be, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM. 440-TOM, 866-440-THOM. And our website, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. And you can just drop in, click the live chat link, and it'll get you there. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Wild news out of Detroit this week. Delphi Corporation?
The Delphi Corporation went into bankruptcy, filed bankruptcy for bankruptcy. And what was interesting is in order to get out of bankruptcy, in order to get themselves together, what they are proposing is that the 34,000 unionized employees at that company, and they are the largest American auto parts manufacturer, get this, they are proposing that these workers take cuts in pay from $26 to $30 an hour down to $10 to $12 an hour. Now, why is this important? Why does it go beyond Michigan and beyond Delphi? Because to my mind, when we talk about the collapse of the middle class, when we talk about corporate America's assault on the middle class, this is a huge step forward. This is not just asking workers to take a cutback in their health insurance. This is not just some diddling around with one's pension. This is a savage cut, a 50% reduction in wages, moving us very clearly in the direction of Mexico or China, moving us in the direction of a third world country. And when you couple what Delphi is doing, one of the major corporations in the Midwest, with what we're seeing nationally, where last year, the last statistics that we had from the IRS in 2003 showed that 99% of taxpayers had incomes in 2003 that were below inflation. In other words, they're losing ground. The only people who did better than inflation were the richest 1%, and the people who really did well were the top 0.1%. So what we are seeing is the continuation of savage attacks on the middle class. 5 million people more in poverty today than before Bush became president, and the wealthiest people in our country have never had it so good. And in Washington, as the Republican leadership figures out how, in the midst of an $8 trillion national debt, they want to pay for Katrina and other needs, what they are proposing are savage cutbacks on the needs of the middle class and low-income people, cutbacks on food stamps, cutbacks on the school lunch program, cutbacks on education. Meanwhile, many of them want to continue to go forward and say, gee, let's give more tax breaks for the rich who have never had it so good. And there is still, if you can believe it, discussion about repealing the estate tax, which will be $1 trillion in tax breaks over the next 20 years, all of which goes to the wealthiest 2%, half of it to the top 0.1%. So what we're seeing, Tom, is just an acceleration of the process by which the middle class is being battered. People can't afford to send their kids to college. They can't afford childcare. They're losing their health insurance. Their pensions are under attack. Bush and his friends want to privatize Social Security, privatize Medicare. We are in a savage assault against the middle class. And if we don't fight back, there is not going to be a middle class to leave our kids.
You know, Bernie, I think a lot of Americans can just they can't quite wrap their heads around it because it almost seems like treason. How could it be that politicians, an entire political party by and large, the Republican Party, good chunks of the Democratic Party, how could it be that they would be so willing to sell out their country to destroy the middle class? There must be some good, some noble purpose. And I think some people kind of clicked when that first $87 billion that John Kerry voted for Iraq, that had the provision that a corporation, if it got that federal money, had to be an American corporation, and the Republicans shot it down and replaced it with one that allowed Halliburton to reincorporate KBR off in the Cayman Islands so that they didn't have to pay income taxes, and said, oh no, it doesn't have to be an American corporation. I think a lot of Americans are starting to say, oh, wait a minute, is this really about multinational corporations who have no loyalty to the United States? Is that the bottom line here?
Well, that is the bottom line, is that in Washington today, virtually every piece of legislation that gets to the floor of the House is bought and paid for. You may have seen, I was kind of surprised by this. Last week, Newsweek, which is, you know, an establishment magazine, called, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but called Tom DeLay's House of Representatives the most corrupt in modern American history. And what DeLay acknowledged to the reporter is, yeah, of course, when people come in, if they're not prepared to contribute to the Republican Party, of course he's not going to meet with those people. Why would he want to do that? And whether it is the bankruptcy bill that you referred to, whether it is the disastrous energy bill, which gave billions in corporate welfare to oil companies at a time when, of course, the oil companies are some of the most profitable corporations in America, whether it is the prescription drug Medicare bill that was written by the pharmaceutical industry, and the main author in the House of Representatives, Billy Pazin of Louisiana, is now working for the pharmaceutical industry. You name the legislation, and it is written by lobbyists and large corporations. And do these folks have an identity? Do they really stay up nights worrying about America? No, they don't. They worry about the compensation of the top CEOs. They worry about corporate profits. And if they can make more money going to China and paying people there 30 cents an hour, they're on their way. That is very, very clear. So they are selling out. I think it is fair to say that major corporation after major corporation is selling out the American middle class. They are contributing huge sums of money. You know, when we talk about why Bush does what he does, why the Republican leadership, why DeLay does what they do, the answer is they get huge sums of money and campaign contributions from the wealthy and the powerful who say, give us tax breaks. Let us go to Mexico. Let us pollute. It's a piece in my front page of my local newspaper today. Latest rules would allow more pollution. We're looking at an epidemic of asthma in this country. We're looking at a situation where hundreds of thousands of kids have mercury in their systems, which could affect their cognitive capabilities. And a lot of this mercury is coming right from coal-burning plants in the Midwest. And these plants and these companies have contributed huge sums of money to Bush. So if it is making our kids sick, so what? You get campaign contributions from these large corporations. That's really what's important. And in the midst of the DeLay scandals and everything else, without getting into his legal problems now, we'll let the courts decide those. Let's not forget that what DeLay is about is working day and night for the largest and wealthiest people in this country and going after the middle class and low-income people. And that is something the American people just have got to address.
And now, as many people are going to be facing bankruptcy as a result of the hurricanes along the southeastern coast of the United States, many people, no doubt, many of the former employees of Delphi, you know, having your pay cut in half, facing bankruptcy. We have this new bankruptcy law, and today, front page of the New York Times, a requirement, the new bankruptcy law that sends Americans into credit counseling before they can erase their debts is drawing criticism from consumer advocates, bankruptcy lawyers, and financial educators who are concerned that the creditors are subsidizing the counseling.
What a shock. Particular piece of legislation, Tom, was written by the banks and the credit card companies. That's an issue, by the way, in the midst of all of these things. As the standard of living of the American middle class declines, as poverty increases, people are more and more dependent on their credit cards. They are borrowing money to pay for groceries. And meanwhile, then, what you have is the credit card companies charging people 25, 28% interest rates, huge late fees, and all other kinds of fees. By the way, we've got legislation in to end this usury, because that's really what it is. But it is one of many outrages that are currently taking place in D.C.
One of many. Congressman Bernie Sanders, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM. We'll be back with your calls for Bernie after this. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Our first hour here, Brunch with Bernie, every week. Congressman Bernie Sanders, America's, I call him America. I think of Bernie as America's congressman. He's the only independent member of Congress. He also does an incredible job of representing the state of Vermont, where I lived for 10 years. And I am just, so pleased to have you here, Bernie. Bernie, let's go to the phones. Jeff in Everett, Washington on the line. Hey, Jeff, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. Hey, Congressman, got a question for you. First off, I agree with what you're saying about what they're doing with the middle class, because I think we'll all end up having to live in Mexico by the time by the middle of this century. But what I was curious about was, what were your take on the on the press conference yesterday in Iraq? Mind you, I'm a veteran who's been in Desert Storm and been over there for Iraqi freedom myself, and I was just kind of appalled by the fact that there were no junior enlisted people. I mean, anyone who would have a possibility to stand up and say, "Mr. President, what the heck are we doing here?" What were your takes on that?
Well, Jeff, I think a couple of points. First of all, what that was is one more of a continuous flow of photo opportunities. And what that was supposed to be about is, we have a hands-on president who wants to know what's going on the ground, and he's calling up the men and women who are really fighting the war, and he's going to get real information from them. And, of course, as the papers indicated, what this was a prepackaged teleconference. The questions had been agreed upon, and each soldier was going to respond in a way that had already been planned. So it was a photo opportunity. It reminds me very much of an adage that Karl Rove made some years back. And he said, you know, when you think about politics, think about turning on the TV and turning down the sound and just having the image there. And that's what it was about. So the theory behind this, the president's talking to the men and women on the ground, getting information. They're telling him things are going well and so forth and so on. That's what that was about. And I think in this instance, the media did a pretty good job in saying this was nothing more than a photo opportunity. Obviously, the president's support for the war in Iraq is plummeting. More and more people are understanding that we went there under false premises, that we were totally unprepared for what happened. And my own particular view is that we have got to start bringing home our troops as soon as we can, and that should be in the not very distant future.
Well said. Dave in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Dave, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
I have a question about the new double your minimum credit card payment that's coming up. I guess some companies already have done it already. Some of mine are going to be coming up in January. For those who are living week to week, do you have any way that we can settle out of these things and that we don't get taken again from another meet the new boss, same as the old boss?
Dave, I don't. I mean, these are the ripoff of the credit card companies is an issue that I think more and more Americans are concerned about. It's an issue that I'm on the Financial Services Committee and some of us are working on, but I can't give you a specific answer to your question, except to say that what's going on in America now in terms of credit cards is really usury. People should not be being charged 25, 28% interest rates. And some of us, at least, are trying to deal with that.
Beth in Portland, Oregon. Beth, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Bernie.
The Senate desperately needs you. Thank you for running.
Thank you.
But I have a major concern about elections, which segues right into your conversation with Tom about private corporations. And as you probably know, that most of the votes in the United States are being counted on trade secret software, which is programmed by for-profit corporations. And in Vermont, most of your votes are counted on Diebold scanners and tabulators, and the software is not accessible even to the Secretary of State. And yet citizens are being asked to trust the results of the election in spite of the fact that Diebold has an extensive and well-documented history of vote count errors. And Vermont, as is the case with nearly all the states, has no election audit or procedure in place to verify the accuracy of the vote count. So I have a major concern about this. Shouldn't our elections be based on checks and balances rather than faith and trust?
Well, Betsy, you're absolutely right. I am not sure you're correct about Vermont, by the way. But Tom and I have discussed this, and Tom has done a lot of writing on this.
Actually,
the idea,
Bernie, I've talked with Deb Markowitz, and the scanners that count, you know, we do paper ballots mostly in Vermont,
right.
But when you feed that paper ballot through a scanner and the scanner counts the vote, that's Diebold.
That is Diebold.
Yeah.
Well,
sure enough.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Betsy's right, and I'm wrong. This is a huge issue, Betsy. I mean, voting and elections are the cornerstone of what a democracy is about, and the idea that somebody would say that we have proprietary information that public officials can't have when we're counting votes is absolutely outrageous. All of that has got to be in the public sector, no question about that.
Yeah, just make it absolutely transparent to the extent that we can. We have about a half a minute. Harriet in Seattle, quick question for Bernie. Hey, Harriet.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
This is regarding Pakistan. They need all the help we can get, and I'm all in favor of moving all the troops who can out of Afghanistan. They're not doing anything anyway. I mean, they're not winning. It's a disaster. And moving that equipment in to help. But I guess my question is, in light of what we still need in this country regarding the Gulf Coast, why is Bush committing some, what was it, $50 or $80 billion? And
to Pakistan.
Yeah, to Pakistan.
Okay. We'll let Bernie answer that question on the backside of this break. We've got to go to a break. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Mama, it's hard to hide because you know I'm 6'5" in a land where the people are short. I just slip on a burka, head on down to Loya Jirga, poke around all day at the Sharia court.
Oh, that's right. It's the Osama song. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our toll-free number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. For those of you who don't have letters on your phones, I know some cell phones don't. 866-440-8466. And let's go back to the phone lines here.
Tom, we had Harriet's question.
That's right. Thank you,
okay.
Bernie.
Harriet's question was essentially, can we afford to help the people in Pakistan? And I think not only that we can, that we must. What the United States and other industrialized countries must show people in the Muslim world is that we take their problems seriously. We're not going to turn our backs on them. And I think in this terrible earthquake, something like 30, 40,000 people dead, yeah, we should be there. Now, the question is, where do you get the money? Do you take that money away from the food stamp program? Take that money away from our veterans? No, you don't. What we have to do is reorder national priorities. That means you don't give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the richest 1%. You don't give billions more in corporate welfare, much of it going to companies that are throwing American workers out on the street and going to China. You don't build weapon systems that this country doesn't need. But I think, along with other industrialized countries, Harriet, we have got to show the people in the Muslim world and elsewhere that we really do care about them, or else they really are going to continue to fall for the Osama bin Laden line. And from a moral point of view and from the point of view of fighting terrorism, that's clearly not good.
And that's really the way to win the war on terrorism.
Right, it is. It is, to show those people that we do care about them, that we do worry when 40,000 people get killed in an earthquake, that we want to help rebuild their country. And we and other industrialized nations can do that. But to do it well, without hurting the American people, we've got to reorder our own national priorities.
Okay, well said. Matt in Sacramento, California, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Well, hi. How are you guys?
Great.
First of all, I appreciate that a congressman would actually address the public directly as he's doing, and that's a rarity.
Oh, Bernie's been doing that every week on this program for, I think we're pushing 2 years now.
Well, that's why I listen.
Well over one.
Anyway, I wanted to point out something that it seems like we're always trying to fix up something that can't be fixed. Namely, if you want the people to rule in a country that's we the people, you cannot have an oligarchy. And representative government, by definition, is an oligarchy. By definition. And if you want proof of that, go back to Rousseau. And as he wrote, as soon as you, instead of going to council and representing yourself, which is democratic direct democracy, you will have representatives to sell your country.
Matt, you know, exactly rather than getting into a philosophical argument about what the definition of oligarchy is, what's your question for Congressman Sanders?
My question is, do you really think that it's possible to have what we've got now, which is an oligarchy, represent the common person?
Okay.
Well, I don't know that you're going to ever have it 100% the way we want it. You're never going to have a real pure democracy. But we can do a heck of a heck of a heck of a lot better than we're doing right now. Matt, when I look at the word oligarchy, what that means to me is people with wealth and power ruling. And in fact, that is exactly what's going on today. They're ruling the economy, they're ruling the media, and they're certainly ruling the political process. Can we change that? We sure can. We can do it, among other things, through campaign finance reform, which ends the ability of people with money to get elected or to elect people who represent their interests. That would be a very important step forward.
1-866-440-THOM. Julie in Eureka, California, on, listening on KGOE. Hey, Julie, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Julie.
I'm just honored to speak with you today. And I wanted to talk about something you touched on with that last caller, and that is the media problem that we have. As consumers of the media, we have no control over what is coming out of our sets or onto our print anymore, it seems to me. And I heard you speak on this. I saw it on a public airwave here in our area a few months back, where you spoke about how the White House really controls what is news and sells to the media the version that they want us to receive. And I really want to find a way to try and take back the power of we, the consumers, buying the media, should have some say in what is news and how we can
right.
try to bring that back.
Julie, that's an excellent point and an excellent question. As Tom and I have discussed many times, we are very concerned. I am very concerned. I know Tom is. About the growing concentration of ownership in media today, the fact that you have the same multinational media conglomerates controlling television, radio, magazines, newspapers, and you're down to really almost a handful of companies who control the flow of information. That is a huge, huge problem. Now, the good news there is that Bush and his friends try to deregulate media even more, giving power to even fewer companies. We were able to stop them last year because millions of people said, wait a second, you got to be crazy. The situation is bad today. Let's not make it worse. Now, Julie, let me give you a radical suggestion. I don't think that people have to simply sit back. I think they can be aggressive on this issue, and I think we got to think politically in this sense. You can go to your local newspaper and say, excuse me, you know, what you're reporting, the columnists that you have, or the way you are doing news, what you consider to be important is not necessarily the real issues facing ordinary Americans. And we want you to sit down with a group of us to tell you what we think the kind of coverage that makes sense to our community. So let's get aggressive. Let's go into our local newspapers. Let's go into our local radio stations. They virtually never hear from their consumers. And I think we should take it to them far more than has been the case.
Arlene in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Congressman Sanders. I am honored to speak with you, first of all. This is a follow-up call to Drake's call about the credit card companies.
Mm-hmm.
The usury is one issue. There's no question. But people with better credit ratings get lower credit card
right.
interest rates. So that's number one. So usury is not my primary concern, although it is a concern. I mean, it is an outrageous rate that they charge. However, the new regulations that are doubling the amount that consumers have to pay from national banks is being regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of Currency. And the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, which apparently is administered under the United States Treasury Department, which is appointed by the President.
Right.
You know, so the legislative branch is not involved in this at all. No. So the OCC is issuing regulations to national banks that they have to do this. And where are they getting this authority from without Congress being involved in this?
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah,
the answer is that Congress can do anything it wants. If Congress wants to stop an action, it can. Generally speaking, in many areas, the president has a lot of authority to do things. Congress wanted to stop it, they could stop it tomorrow. So every issue is something within the jurisdiction of Congress. And this is an issue that our Financial Services Committee, if I have anything to say about, will look at. But unfortunately, the House Financial Services Committee is very, very heavily dominated by banks and credit card companies, so I won't hold my breath for a good result. But this is an issue that we should take a hard look at.
A trucker in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the line. Hey, sir, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Yeah, you're live on the air.
Well, I have a question for Mr. Sanders. I was wondering if he would be supportive of an expansion of the House of Representatives, the number of seats, therefore making the constituency sizes much smaller and making a more direct connection between the people and their representative. The reason that money rules right now is because it costs so much money to campaign in a very large constituency of about 620,000 people, and the Constitution says 30,000, and that's the problem. We need smaller constituencies.
Well, it's an interesting concept. The negative of that is, let me tell you, we've got 435 people in the House today, which is a pretty unwieldy group of folks. It's very, very large. If you expand it to 600, 700, 800 people, God, I'm not quite sure how there'll be any cohesion, or it'll be just even that much more difficult to get work done. I think that the bottom line of the problem is right now, as the caller indicates, it's money in politics, but it's not just because members of Congress represent 600 plus thousand people. It is a system which is designed to be expensive, so that the playing field is stacked in favor of those people who can pay the freight. And I think the answer to it is not just to make Congress bigger. I don't think that. I think it is real campaign finance reform, public funding of elections, limits on the amount of money that can be spent.
And back before 1986-87, when Reagan did away with not just the Fairness Doctrine, but most of the rules that required corporations, news corporate, radio stations, television stations, networks, to carry real news and to perform a public service in order to keep their licenses. It didn't cost that much to run for office because stations sponsored debates, and now essentially, if a politician wants to get on the air, they got to buy their way onto the air.
You got to buy your way through TV ads, which are just extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah, and so that's another thing that can be fixed by a legislative process.
Yeah.
We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. The telephone number 1-866-440-THOM. And we will be back right after this, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough.
The going gets tough. That's when the tough get going. Welcome back, my friends. It's 9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. And Bernie, let's go back to the telephone lines here. John in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania on the phone. John, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, Tom, you are like a modern version of the Boston Tea Party of Washington. And I think of old King George, and I think of President George Bush. In any case, my question is on the president on Iraq uses the term complete and total victory. Has Congress done anything to hold the White House accountable for what it says in terms of outlining goals, a plan, a limits in governing that much resources out of the people? And Bernie, do you have a definition of what the president actually means, total and complete victory? Do you have something that you can tell us about what you think about that?
Well, John, thank you very much for that excellent question. The answer is that a growing minority of us in Congress are trying to do exactly that. What does a successful mission mean? In the United States, we have tens of millions of people who don't vote. People are worried about balloting. Do you think we're going to establish a perfect democracy in Iraq? I think not. What we are trying to do is, for a start, have the president give us an exit strategy. How many more years are our troops going to remain in Iraq? 1,900 of them plus are now dead. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent. Are we going to have this discussion 5 years from now, 8 years from now? What do we mean by completing the mission? The president, other than using rhetoric, has not been clear about it. But my own view is what we should focus on now is an exit strategy, a way to begin withdrawing our troops, supporting the Iraqi military, supporting the Iraqi government, and that's what we want to do. Second point is, I think, John, in terms of your question, the oversight on the part of Congress with regard to the war has been absolutely minimal, virtually non-existent. There have been no hearings in the House about the president's assertions about weapons of mass destruction. Why did he say that? What does that mean? Et cetera, et cetera. No hearings about how come we were so unprepared for what, in fact, has taken place, et cetera, et cetera. So when I talk about being critical of the Republican leadership in the House, one way that they have just been absolutely derelict in their responsibilities is not performing the constitutional role of oversight, holding the administration accountable.
Well said. 1-866-440-THOM. Leonard in Thousand Oaks, California. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes. Good morning, Congressman. I want to address an issue, and I really don't want to point any disrespect at you personally, but the Democrats have got to stop acting like Republicans in order to win elections. During the vote that got us into Iraq, the Democrats could have stopped this whole thing cold in its tracks by getting together and voting the way that their hearts told them to vote and kept us out of there. It was their votes that went towards that.
Can I interrupt you just to ask you, first of all, I'm not a Democrat, but second of all, let me ask you a question.
Oh, I know that.
There's a lot of confusion about this. What percentage of Democrats in the House do you believe voted against giving the president authority to go to war?
I don't know.
The answer is it was about 57%. So a majority of Democrats said no to the president. I know about that because I was actively involved in trying to see those numbers grow. We had meetings with just a few at the beginning, and it grew. The American people told their members they didn't want to go to war. So the first point is a majority of members in the Democratic Party, in fairness to them, did not give the president authority. They voted against it. We could not have stopped it because virtually all of the Republicans voted with the president. But could they have been more assertive? The problem there was the Democratic leadership more than the rank-and-file Democrats in the House. But your point is well taken.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Leonard. Appreciate the comment. Let's see here. Tony in Youngstown, Ohio on the line. Hey, Tony, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Well, thank you, Tom. Pleasure to meet you, and Bernie, too. I have a little question for you, Bernie, about the hurricane relief and all the other strife that seems to be happening in the world that we seem to be supporting. And that is there any way that we can people
Tony, you just broke up and we lost you. We'll go to Dick in Seattle, Washington. Dick, you're live with Congressman Sanders. Real quick.
Yes, Bernie, given that our corporate mainstream electronic media controls what we know, how we think about issues, and who we vote for in large part, isn't it vital for working people, liberals and progressives, to have their own news network, much like the neoconservatives have Fox, NBC, CBS, and ABC?
You're talking about TV here.
Pardon me?
You're talking about TV.
Talking about radio and television. If we want to reclaim our democracy, isn't it vital that we have our own media in that regard? And how might we best fund that? And also, don't we need to start our own mainstream liberal media rating services like the largely conservative ones that now exist?
Dick, I think your point is a very good point. I can remember 20 years ago speaking to the head of the AFL-CIO and saying, you know, you guys should start putting money into cable television, develop a progressive television network. The answer is yes. The negative of that, the problem there is to start a network, a TV network, cost probably now tens of billions of dollars. And obviously one advantage that the right has over progressives is the right has ties to corporate America and they have a whole lot of money. That's the bad news. The good news is, I have to say, that in the last couple of years, because of people like Tom Hartman, Al Franken, and many others, our presence, a progressive presence on talk radio, is significantly higher now than it was just a few years ago. So we are making some progress. But to answer Dick's question, we have a very, very long way to go, and it should be a major priority.
Yeah, well said, Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.org. Check it out, bernie.org, also bernie.house.gov. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, my favorite segment of the week, our Brunch with Bernie segment. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, telling the truth that the multinational corporations, really rather you weren't all that aware of. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program, where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program, 6.5 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bridget Amiri is with us. She's the staff attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project. Hey, Bridget.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Roe v. Wade is very much becoming a hot issue, particularly with Harriet Myers. I mean, there was a cartoon in USA Today, with a big billboard up on top of the White House that said, Harriet Myers will vote to cancel Roe v. Wade. You know, and underneath the thought balloon, you know, George looking up going, I wonder if I'm being too subtle. And it's just, this is a big deal. And the talking points on the right, I just wanted to toss them out and give you a chance to inform us and all, me and all of our listeners about some of these issues.
Sure.
Number one, the main talking point that's being made is more of a practical one, which is that if the Supreme Court were to invalidate Roe v. Wade today, it would have no effect whatsoever because it doesn't actually outlaw abortion. The individual states would then have to do that on a state-by-state basis, or the federal government would have to do that. Is that accurate?
Well, I think it's actually inaccurate and completely misstating the impact that an overruling of Roe versus Wade would have on the country. There are at least half the states, maybe less than half the states in the United States that would outlaw abortion. And so the issue would go back to the states, but the women who live in those states would be without access to abortion. And as with the time pre-Roe v. Wade, and also even today, as we're seeing more restrictions placed on access to abortion, it's the women who live in rural communities, poor women, young women who would really be the ones who would be unable to exercise their right to choose. With most things, and with the rich people can travel, they can find abortion in places, but it would be those women who are at a disadvantage. So if they live in one of those perhaps 19, 20 states that are going to outlaw abortion, unless they can travel someplace, they will have no right at all.
Roe v. Wade, though, was about more than just abortion, was it not? I mean, wasn't it really fundamentally about whether women have access? Wasn't it in some ways a repudiation of the 1873 case, Bradwell versus State, in which the Supreme Court ruled that women only had rights through their husbands and fathers? And Roe v. Wade, in many ways, was a repudiation of that. It was saying women have rights under the Bill of Rights, under the Constitution.
Well, absolutely. It's a logical extension of women's ability to control their reproduction as and need to be equal members of society. And also, even going back not as far, it's also a logical extension of Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, I believe, which held that it was unconstitutional to place restrictions on access to contraceptives for married couples. And then a few years later, that same ruling was applied to unmarried couples. So it goes back to not just women's ability to control their reproduction in order to control the number of spacing of their children in order to be equal participants in society, but also for both members of the sex to be able to control their reproductive lives.
One of the arguments that's made, and Scalia actually wrote a fairly eloquent piece on this some years ago, and I read it, and I thought, you know, it's hard to disagree with this, and give me some help here with this.
Sure.
His point was that in Roe v. Wade, because the court said there are three different trimesters to pregnancy, we're going to arbitrarily define three different stages of pregnancy, first, second, and third trimester, you know, three-month periods, and we're going to have different rules for each one of these three trimesters, that the court was making law, because that kind of finely sliced and diced definition of anything, pregnancy or anything else, is really the function of the legislative branch, that the court should have basically said either any law that has to do with abortion is against the law, or all, you know, any law that has to do with abortion is fine with us. And that when they started slicing and dicing, they really got into the legislative, into doing what legislators should do rather than what judges should do. And that's been, you know, that's their argument when they say legislating from the bench. By and large, I believe that's what they're talking about. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I think a couple of things. The first is that the trimester framework was not at all arbitrary. In fact, it was basically following what doctors do. And when doctors consider the different stages of pregnancy, doctors break it down into the trimester approach. And so what Justice Blackmun did in Roe v. Wade was just that, was follow what medicine tells us. And then from that, said that certain restrictions would be permissible during certain stages of pregnancy when the state's interests are perhaps increased as the fetus develops. Certainly after viability, a state can outlaw abortion except for to protect the circumstances where the woman's health or her life are at risk. But subsequent to Roe, in 1992, the court decided Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which basically obliterated the trimester framework. So we're no longer operating under the trimester framework. And we have a new set of rules that the states must abide by when passing restrictions on access to abortion. And that's the current framework and the current state of the law.
And what's the essence of that new set of rules?
The new set of rules is that states may pass restrictions on access to abortion unless they place a substantial obstacle in the path of women seeking abortion. And in circumstances where that substantial obstacle occurs for a large fraction of women, the statute should be invalidated.
So it sounds like you just said that states can put obstacles in the way, but they can't be substantial obstacles?
That's pretty much correct, yes.
And who decides what's substantial?
Well, I mean, the courts do to a large extent. I mean, in Casey, the court considered a number of different abortion restrictions, only one of which they found to be unconstitutional, and that was the spousal notice requirement. But the Supreme Court has given states the framework for restricting abortions with respect to minors' rights, waiting periods, informed consent, or what we call bias counseling, and what the states, in order to pass constitutional restrictions, can look to prior Supreme Court precedents when doing that and follow those guidelines.
We're talking with Bridget Amiri, who's a staff attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project. The website, aclu.org/reproductive rights, or just aclu.org, is a great starting point. And if you're not a member of the American Civil Liberties Union, join now! It's a great organization. Bridget, I don't know to what extent you want or don't want to talk about the about Harriet Myers and where she's at on this. Let me just toss that out to you.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that the ACLU has only opposed in its 85-year history two nominations to the Supreme Court. So we rarely, as a general principle, institutionally take positions on Supreme Court nominations. That being said, we obviously hope that whoever is confirmed as someone who will protect all civil rights, including the right to choose. And we rarely see how a justice will vote in reproductive rights cases until they've been on the bench for some time. You can see O'Connor's opinions on the issue shaped after a few years on the bench, same with Justice Kennedy. It takes some time to find their footing. So I think even regardless of what happens in the confirmation process and regardless of what happens in the first few years, we may not have a clear idea of a particular justice's views on reproductive rights until after they've settled in a bit.
And the ACLU is not taking a position on this nominee?
We actually haven't decided yet. It's a little too new. It's something our board votes on. We did not take a position on Judge Roberts, now Chief Justice Roberts, and we're currently in the process of considering the Myers appointment.
Yeah, I would think over 85 years, only opposing two, they would have to be very egregious, particularly with regard to First Amendment rights, which is your primary mandate.
Well, it's the Bill of Rights in general, and the two that we have opposed in the past were Justice Rehnquist and Justice Thomas.
Interesting. Very interesting. So just very quickly, we just have a half a minute or so here.
Sure.
If the court were to take on Roe v. Wade, do you expect that there, and let's say that Myers and Roberts both are anti-abortion, do you think that the court would simply strike this whole thing down, or do you think that there would be a more gradual process, that they'd begin nibbling away at it?
I think much more gradual process. We will see an evisceration of the right to choose. We will not see immediately an outright reversal of Roe. There are enough votes on the court to protect the basic concept of Roe, which is that the Constitution protects women's right to privacy to control their reproduction. But, however, I think the bigger picture is that we will see more and more states passing restrictions that affect access, and we'll see more and more courts voting to uphold those restrictions. And we're also seeing a huge decline in the number of providers, which is also something that will affect access as well.
And already is.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Is. Bridget Amiri, staff attorney with the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project, www.aclu.org. Thank you so much, Bridget, for being
with us
today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I do appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started.
Yeah, it sounds like a plan. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here on the No Boring Zone. Welcome back to our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. Get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer for that matter. Give them a call. Tell them we said hi. 1-800-511-MACS. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Maggie Thatcher. Maggie Thatcher. She's the one, this whole Bush thing, this whole let's go to war in Iraq, in large part was inspired by Reagan watching Maggie Thatcher in the Falklands. I mean, that was the kind of inspiration, the beginning point, whatever it was. Maggie Thatcher decided to take her country to war in the Falkland Islands, you know, with Argentina, and it worked very well. There was a nice, short war. I mean, from the British point of view, the Argentinians are still a little upset about it. A nice, short war. They got the island back. You know, the three people and 5,000 sheep or whatever it was, they got the island back. And when the British fleet sailed into the harbor in London, everybody came out and standing applause for Maggie Thatcher. And she was the heroine of the day. And Ronald Reagan said, hey, I can do this. And boom, off we go into Grenada. And, you know, the idea was, hey, you invade little countries that can't fight back. And, you know, you get brownie points for that because everybody likes a successful warrior, right? And so George W. Bush, yeah, well, we'll invade a country that can't fight back. Look at this, Iraq. We in 91, we took out all their weapons of mass destruction, and we had Scott Ritter in there for 6-8 years. He's got a new book out, by the way. It's excellent. It took out all their weapons of mass destruction, and we bombed their air force into smithereens. We've had these no-fly zones. We've shot up their radar. They've had a war with Iran for a decade where over 1 million of their soldiers have died. They've got nothing basically but, you know, 16-year-old conscripts now. Easy. We'll take them. And it was easy, and we did take them. And, you know, George W. Bush was, you know, absolutely right when he declared victory. Hostilities are over. You know, it's
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
We did. For a short time. We had a successful invasion and a lousy occupation. Well, now Maggie Thatcher, the woman who started the whole thing, Baroness Thatcher, this from The Independent, the British newspaper, The Independent, Baroness Thatcher has criticized Tony Blair for taking Britain to war in Iraq on the basis of flawed evidence about Saddam Hussein's weapons. This had to be a huge embarrassment, as Mr. Blair was among the 670 guests who attended a birthday party for her, for Maggie Thatcher. It's her 80th birthday. And they all show up for her birthday. They're going to be here for her birthday party. Isn't it cool? And she gets up and she says, this is the first time, by the way, that she was asked. Yesterday's Washington Post reported that when she was asked whether she would have invaded Iraq, given the intelligence at the time, she said, I was a scientist before I was a politician, and as a scientist, I know you need facts, evidence, and proof, and then you check, recheck, and check again. She added, the fact is, there were no facts, there was no evidence, and there was no proof. As a politician, the most serious decision you make is to commit your armed services to war from which they may not return. Pretty amazing. The article was written by the journalist Tina Brown, who said she had been told Lady Thatcher's view by Lord Palumbo, the former chairman of the Arts Council, who asked the former prime minister about Iraq when he had lunch with her 6 months ago. And, you know, on it goes. And so here, poor Tony Blair, he must have been sitting in the audience fried, you know, well cooked, well done, and not more than just a little bit upset. John Fund in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, yesterday, noting that the offices of both Vice President Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez, both of them, tried to block the nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. This in the Wall Street Journal. A last-minute effort was made to block the choice of Ms. Myers, including the offices of Vice President Dick Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez. Let's hear what Victoria Jones has to say about that and other things. Hey, Victoria, by the way, I saw you on TV last night. I think it was on MSNBC on Keith Olbermann's program.
No, I wasn't on.
You sure were. He was doing a piece about how Scotty melted down in the press conference, and they did a cutaway to the questioners, and you were sitting in the row behind the guy who was having it out with Scotty, and we heard you yell, I have a question about judicial philosophy,
that's right.
And we saw your face several times. You were on MSNBC yesterday.
That's right. Oh, well, that's very funny. Yes, I have a question about judicial philosophy.
There you go. I'm sitting there. Louise, that's Victoria. That's Victoria. She's like, yeah, that's cool. You looked great. It looked great. We only have a minute left here, Victoria. What's the hot news out of Washington?
Well, Karl Rove's out of the grand jury. Scott McClellan's being asked whether, you know, surely that there's a lack of focus if he's having to have his time taken up with this, and what's the president doing about advice, and we're being told that the president has a great team around him, and there's absolutely no acknowledgement whatsoever that Karl Rove's time with his lawyers has detracted from his work.
So. It's the old don't talk about it, maybe it'll go away strategy,
yes,
is that it?
Put our heads in the sand and stand in the corner.
Yeah, Ostrich 101 here from the Bush administration. Okay, Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's always good talking with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to New Orleans.
Federal, state, and local governments are working side by side to sustain lives by ensuring adequate food, water, shelter, and medical supplies for survivors and dedicated citizens, our dislocated citizens.
At that time, he was making a big deal about telling the nation that the convention center had been secured.
FEMA's moving supplies and equipment into the hardest hit areas.
All they had done, as Geraldo Rivera actually reported on Fox, was they locked people in.
This is it. This is it. No sugarcoating, no political spin, no Republicans or Democrats. People suffering. Let them go. Let them out of here. Let them walk over this damn interstate and let them out of here.
I want to get some perspective here, because earlier today the images...
That is perspective.
Hang on a second.
That is all the perspective you need.
Hang on a second.
Anyone who walks up out of that city now is turned around.
I don't know, man. I don't... Let them walk the hell out of here. Let them get on that interstate and walk out to the Walmart on the other side of the river, to some other town, some place where you can help them. All you got here is thousands and thousands of people 6 days later. Same clothes. Where do you think they're going to the bathroom? They don't wash their hands. They don't wash their face. These babies. There are so many babies here. What the hell?
Come on and talk to me.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Yeah, a bit of a montage there of Fox News. Speaking of Fox News, Tony Snow, sitting in for Bill O'Reilly this morning. The president pounced on a quote in Sunday's New York Times Magazine where Senator Kerry called terrorists a nuisance. Well, this is not new language. I got to tell you, my friends, this is not new language. When you attack, when Republicans attack Democrats, or when conservatives attack liberals or progressives for is supposedly being weak against an enemy that's going to destroy us, right? Joe McCarthy. A few days ago, I read that President Eisenhower expressed the hope that by election time in 1954, the subject of communism would be a dead and forgotten issue. The raw, harsh, unpleasant fact is that communism is an issue and will be an issue in 1954. In fact, here, Joe McCarthy himself.
Men like that grand old man of the Senate, the great Democrat Pat McCarran, men like Bill Jenner and others have been trying to slowly dig out and expose to the public view those who would destroy this nation. Now you will see, you are seeing today, an all-out attempt to marshal the forces of the opposition, using not merely the communists, but the fellow travelers, the deluded liberals, the eggheads, and some of my good friends in both the Democrat and Republican Party, who can become heroes overnight in the eyes of the left-wing press if they will join with the jackal pack.
As you can see, this is a discussion that's been going on for a long, long time. We'll carry this on in a little bit. First, though, I want to go to Heather. Heather Heidelbaugh, who is with the media panelist with the Republican National Lawyers Association, former chair of Pennsylvania Lawyers for Bush Cheney. Hey, Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. Roe v. Wade, if we could talk about this for a few moments. What is the position of the Republican National Lawyers Association with regard to Roe v. Wade?
No position.
No position. And what's your position about it?
Personally?
Sure.
Pro-life.
Okay, what does that mean?
I believe Roe was decided incorrectly.
Why?
Well, first off, I believe that life begins at conception, and there are not adequate protections in Roe versus Wade for that scientific reality. In addition, I don't believe in the Constitution contains a right to privacy.
Okay, well, that's two interesting things. Let's take them one at a time. First of all, your suggestion that life begins at conception, that seems to be the core predicating assumption for all of the opposition to Roe v. Wade. And if you assume that life begins at conception, that, you know, human life begins at conception, then, you know, you have a fairly strong case. Didn't the court, though, suggest that life begins at viability, sort of like the Bible suggests that life begins when a baby takes his first breath? I mean, there have been different definitions of when human life begins over the years.
Well, I think you're right that there certainly have been, but I think that Roe was wrong. I don't think that, in fact, when you look at Roe carefully and you look at where science is today, it was decided almost 30 years ago. I mean, babies are living now and being able to be sustained at 20 weeks. So that certainly wasn't viability 30 years ago. It's just, you know, it's a philosophical and ethical and moral and religious question, I suppose, in tossed in with a scientific question. But at the last breath of our life, is it still life? Yes. At the beginning moment of the creation of life, is it life? Yes.
Is it life when a husband and wife decide that they're going to have intercourse and produce a baby?
If the egg and the sperm meet, it sure is.
No, I mean before that. This has been the position of the Catholic Church for a couple of hundred years now, that life occurs even before conception, and that's why you shouldn't have birth control, because the intent is what's producing the life.
Yeah, I think scientifically I would disagree with that. I would think life begins at the moment that the sperm and egg unite.
So whether or not they implant?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that's the ultimate cleaving point, I think, and the point where this argument ultimately is going to be going. And don't you think that the majority of Americans, though, are of the opinion that life, the human life, is that viability is a better definition than this genesis, this point of sperm and egg combining?
No, I don't think so. I think when, first of all, I think people are enormously still undereducated. There's been a great amount of effort throughout the United States through the pro-life organization to provide women who are carrying a child with a sonogram to really depict what in fact is growing inside their womb. And I don't think the vast majority of Americans understand the progression of life. I think there's not a lot of argument the first several days. I mean, it's pretty much a blob of tissue multiplying. Okay,
yeah.
But it then goes beyond that, and I think that there are so many slippery slopes that our culture is about to slide down to.
Sure.
Because we don't respect the sanctity of life at all stages of life, whether it be those who are poor, whether it be those who are mentally retarded, the disabled. I mean, I think that's where the pro-life movement is obviously very afraid that people will be categorized as to their value in society.
Heather Heidelbaugh, if you're suggesting, and I believe you are, that by saying that you're pro-life, you're really in favor of criminalizing abortion, when women get abortions, what form of criminal penalty should they be subject to? I've asked this of several pro-life people I've had. One fellow suggests that they should be either hung, shot, or lethal injection, depending on which state they're in. I've had other people suggest life in prison. Other people suggest that the doctor should be shot. The woman should only get a year in jail. What's your idea of the criminal penalty that should be meted out to women who have abortions once abortions are criminalized the way you'd like them to be?
Well, first of all, I never said that abortions should be criminalized. I'm not sure.
But that's what you're working for, is it not?
I'm not.
Wait, isn't that what the whole point of rolling back Roe v. Wade is, so that individual states can criminalize abortion? Is that not the case?
Absolutely not.
Then why do away with Roe v. Wade?
You suggest in this argument that I have, because you asked me my personal opinion.
Sure.
For you to suggest that I personally am advocating that is unfair, because I haven't given you any groundwork for that.
Okay, well, then tell us, are you in favor of criminalizing abortion or not?
No.
Okay, so you think that Roe v. Wade should stand?
No.
Okay, then what are you going to do if Roe v. Wade gets knocked down and states start criminalizing abortion?
I don't know what states will do. in terms of making it illegal.
Well, we already know that about 20 states have legislatures that have essentially declared that they would like to criminalize abortion. There have been several attempts to that have been rolled back by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we as a society can do. There certainly can be licensure issues with doctors who perform abortions that are not legal in any particular state, and then you would have doctors performing procedures without a license.
So the criminal sanction against the doctors would be...
I don't advocate because I think it is a tragedy for the unborn. I think it is a tragedy for the mother who really doesn't... I don't think there's... The early feminist movement, if you look at feminist history, had nothing whatsoever to do with the destruction of children. It had to do, which I totally agree with allowing women to have better options in life. And I don't believe that most women want the option of killing their child. And so I don't believe that criminalizing a woman or punishing a woman by jail who has undergone an abortion is where our society ought to be. And that's my personal opinion, as you've asked for my personal opinion.
But that's very much the direction that rolling back Roe v. Wade will go, because that's where we were.
Well, you know what? There's been a lot of changes in society in the last 30 years, and I'm not sure that is where the pro-life movement is. When I go to these dinners, when I talk to pro-life people, that's not what's discussed. What's discussed is saving babies.
Oh, sure. And I think everybody's all in favor of saving babies, and I am not pro-abortion. In fact, I've never met anybody who is pro-abortion.
I haven't, and maybe
there's somebody out there who's pro-abortion. But I do remember a girl in my high school class back in the 1960s who died from an infection from getting an illegal abortion. And I just cringe at the idea of those days coming back. Heather Heidelbaugh, a media panelist for the Republican National Lawyers Association. Thank you for being with us, Heather.
Thank you.
It's been a good conversation. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
Hey, Mom, what you doing?
I'm shopping for Dad's gift online, but I'm not having much luck.
Yeah, Dad's pretty tough to shop for.
Maybe I'll get him gift certificates to the movies.
Yeah, but he really doesn't like the multiplex, Ma. What about a Film Movement subscription?
A what?
A Film Movement subscription. It's like a wine of the month club for movies. Film Movement sends you a new independent movie on DVD every month to own for less than the cost of 2 movie tickets.
Really?
Yeah, and with your subscription, you can buy previous Film Movement selections at a discount.
Well, he is always saying how he wishes the film festivals would come to him. So how do I get a Film Movement subscription?
Well, you go to airamericaradio.com, click on the Film Movement banner, and you'll get a discount that makes the price of each DVD in your subscription only $11.90 each.
Finally, a gift I know he'll use.
There's only one Film Movement. To join the DVD of the Month Club Newsweek says is designed to reach the ordinarily neglected movie lover, go to airamericaradio.com now, click on the Film Movement banner, and get your Film Movement discount now. Hurry, supplies are limited.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People,
we
the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour. Our program brought to you today by Motor Silk. 1-866-LESS-FUEL. 1-866-LESS-FUEL. EvergreenAmerica.com, the website. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM. Ruth in Carmel, California. Hey, Ruth, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's up, Ruth?
Well, I was just listening to Heather Heichelbach, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking her position didn't make a lot of sense to me when she said that life begins at conception, because as it turns out, about 50% of all fertilized eggs, human eggs, that is, fail to implant or spontaneously abort. So that it would make sense, if you believe that was truly a human being, that every time a woman missed a period during her reproductive years, you would have a funeral and mourn the loss of this human being, And I don't see that happening among people.
Well, you know, in her defense, I understand what you're saying, but I would not, in Heather's defense, I would say that probably, and I certainly can't put words in her mouth. I apparently she thought I tried to do that once in error. But their argument, I think, would be that if a fertilized egg fails to implant or if you have a miscarriage, that's an act of God. And if, on the other hand, you intervene and create an abortion, that's an act of man or woman or whatever, of humans. And you can't punish God for, you know, wiping out New Orleans, for example. You could punish somebody you could punish Osama bin Laden for trying to wipe out New York. So,
nonetheless, if God killed your child who was 10 years old, you would certainly have a funeral. You would certainly care about it and mourn as the loss of a real human being. And
that's a good point.
I find that the people that think that life begins at conception, they don't follow that idea through. They don't really mean it. I think it's just a convenient thing for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my point.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ruth. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Marjorie in Sacramento, California on the line. Hey, Marjorie.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm great. In fact, I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I just find it very insulting that Heather thinks that women are too stupid to make their own decisions. Because when you were asking her about, you know, how women should be punished, she was like, oh, well, it's not their fault. They, you know, they don't know any better. I find that extremely insulting.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Her suggestion was that I believe, again, I don't want to be putting words in her mouth, but it sounded to me like what she was suggesting was that the way you deal with it is you take abortion out of the realm of medicine. So if a doctor is performing abortions, they're not practicing medicine. They're doing something beyond practicing medicine, and therefore they could lose their license. That would be the criminal penalty that she seemed to be personally recommended.
Well, that's exactly my point. If a woman is going and choosing an abortion, it's because it's improper and it's almost inhumane to bring a child into America right now if you're not rich.
Because well, also
you don't have health care and you don't have good schools.
Yeah, and there's
that's a tough choice for real women.
For sure, absolutely. And you know, here I am, a man. I will never know what it's like to have to face that or to an experience of pregnancy. I mean, I'm the father of three children. I delivered two of them, although my wife would say I didn't deliver them, I caught them. I have some sense of what's involved in pregnancy. And I've known women who have had abortions, and I have some sense, some vague sense of what it must be like to make that decision and live with that decision.
Very difficult.
I'm sure. And I would not, but as a man, I don't think, frankly, that I should even have the right to be voting on this issue.
I appreciate you saying that because I find it very insulting the fact that when you go to Planned Parenthood or something that all these male priests and preachers are out there with teenagers attacking you. And it's just like, how could you even possibly know?
Yeah, if we're going to have a referendum on abortion in the United States, if we are going to have some sort of legal process, we're going to have a vote, and we're going to decide whether or not abortion should be criminalized. And really, I think we need to start framing it as that. Do we want to criminalize abortion or not?
Yeah, because that's what it really
Because that's really what it's about, ultimately.
And do we want women dying from illegal abortions and trying to self-abort?
Right, once again in the United States. So anyhow, if we're going to have a vote about whether or not abortion should be criminalized, frankly, in my opinion, the only people who should be eligible for that vote are women. But that's just, you know, crazy me. Marjorie, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Billy in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Billy.
Hi, Tom. You know, you're wrong about that. There shouldn't be a vote, not by women or anyone else. It's not about voting. That's what people don't seem to understand. Nobody else gets to be a fascist with my wife's vagina. You know, I don't know for sure when conceptual or whatever all that stuff starts. I know when fascism starts.
Good point, Billy.
And let me congratulate you, because what you did get right is the question, okay, what penalty? You know, that's the question to ask them, because none of these sleazy liars, none of these fascists, whether you're talking about Sam Brownback, who's a disgusting human being, but he neither can answer the question. And he's the guy that makes the law. So for him to dodge the question...
Well, I was quite serious with Heather when I told... I don't know if you heard the program or not. It was when I was at the Republican National Convention and doing this show live from the RNC convention back last year in New York City. And they, you know, we were doing the radio row there. And I was there with 30 other conservative talk show hosts and me, right? And they kept bringing guests by and sitting them down in front of me. And they were all, of course, Republicans. And, you know, about maybe one out of every five was from some right-to-life group, you know, with a pin on their lapel. And I asked every one of them, I said, okay, you're in favor, you say you're right for life. That means you're in favor of abortions being criminal, right? And they all said yes. And I said, great, how should we penalize women? And I, honest to God, had one guy say, you know, well, it should be up to the states. I said, is it a capital crime? Is it murder? He's like, yes. And so I said,
for that entirely, because what they're going to do is not penalize the woman. They're going to go after the doctor.
That oh, of course. But the fact of the matter is, in the United States, if you hire somebody to kill somebody else, you're criminally complicit. And if they're going to define abortion as murder, then a woman who gets an abortion is criminally complicit. You know, and she's hired a murder, right? If it's the doctor. And so, I mean, you know, the laws have to be the way the laws are. And we really need to begin asking the question. When we criminalize abortion, when the Republicans criminalize abortion, what will the criminal penalties be? 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of the United States of America, Tom Hartman with you. Strange news today from the Wall Street Journal. In fact, Albert Einstein referred to it as spooky action at a distance. Now, here's how it works. I wrote about this in two different books of mine, in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and The Prophet's Way. It's called entanglement. And the way it works is if you can get particles entangled, and there's two ways to do it. One is to entangle two separate particles, and the other is to split a particle into two pieces. Then they remain connected forever, regardless of time or space. Say what? No, seriously, this is Albert Einstein. It gave him fits. He was like, this can't be possible. This is crazy. Here's how it works. Say you take a particle, or even a particle of light, a photon of light, you know, a packet of light, and you split it, and it goes shooting off in opposite directions into the depths of outer space. And a million miles away, and they're both, say, spinning. And a million miles away, you pass one of those particles through a filter, through a little slot or a filter of some sort that causes its spin to change. The other particle, which is now millions of miles in the other direction, going in the other direction, will instantaneously change. Not after a little while will it change. It's not like they communicate at the speed of light. No, it's instantaneous, regardless of their distance. This Sharon Begley wrote about this in today's Wall Street Journal. She's talking about the crystals in Paul Quaid's physics lab. She said the crystals produce special particles of light that no matter how far apart they ever travel, will always have an eerie connection to one another across the vast reaches of time and space. If a scientist makes a measurement on one particle, which, of course, as Heisenberg pointed out, just simply the act of measuring something modifies it. Simply the act of observing something modifies it. If a scientist makes a measurement on one particle, the other will feel it instantly. And, you know, 70 years ago, Einstein said, no, if, you know, spooky action at a distance, this can't be real. And what's happened is the evidence has just gotten stronger and stronger and stronger for what's called entanglement. Now, there's a couple of implications of this. One is, and they're looking at this seriously, one is that it would allow us to develop an entire new generation of science fiction-like devices for communication. For example, say that there's a star, say that we're involved in space travel. This is an extreme example, but it's an easy one. Say that you're involved in space travel and there's a star that's 100 light years away. Light takes 100 years to get from here to that star. 100 light years away from us. And there's another star that's only 50 light years that's in between. And so if you could measure particles coming from that 50 light year star on one side and you modified them on the other side, the ones on the other side would instantly modify as well. That's called modulation. That's like how radio works. In other words, you could have instantaneous interstellar communication. In fact, you could theoretically do that in the world, here on planet Earth. If you had a source of particles or light waves or whatever, and you modify them on one side, you notice the modification on the other. That's one of the implications. They're using this to quantum computing, super decryption and encryption. I mean, there's all sorts of like real world scientific possibilities with this. But the thing that intrigues me the most is that what this demonstrates is that at least at some level, in some way, what physicists are saying is the same thing that Buddhists and people from all religions, Buddhists probably most overtly, have been saying for thousands of years, which is somehow we're all made out of the same stuff. We're all connected. It's all one. You know, without trying to sound too New Agey here. I think that was what Jesus was talking about. I can never pronounce his name. Maimonides was talking about just go through the list. So anyhow, our interesting little science alert for the day. In the category of Republican alerts, conservative alerts for the day, we have, our conservative alert for the day. Peter DeHart Research Associates just did a survey, a national survey here, just came out. Question. There is now a proposal in Congress to make $35 billion in spending cuts from such programs as federal student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps. The proposal also includes $70 billion in tax cuts. Do you think this proposal reflects the right priorities or wrong priorities for America at this time? Do you feel strongly or not strongly about that? 67% of Americans said these proposals reflect the wrong priorities. 55% of Americans strongly felt that they reflected the wrong priorities. Only 16% of Americans strongly felt that this was the right priority, to cut food stamps, to cut Medicaid, to cut student loans, and to give more tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans. Another question, one part of this proposal is $70 billion in tax cuts. Do you think Congress should pass these tax cuts, or do you think we cannot afford these tax cuts at this time? 25% of Americans said pass the tax cuts. 63% of Americans said we can't afford them. 12% not sure. Another part of the proposal is making $35 billion in spending cuts from such programs as federal student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps. Do you strongly favor, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose these proposed cuts? 71% of Americans in total opposed these cuts to federal student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps. 71% of Americans. And yet in the media, they still call politicians who say such things liberals or radical liberals or leftists. I'm sorry, they are the mainstream of America. That's just the mainstream of America. I was amazed. Louise, was that in USA Today where they were talking, they called Bernie a socialist this morning? Yeah, USA Today had a story. In this story, they're talking about liberal Democrats. They refer to Hillary simply as Hillary. They didn't call her liberal Democrat, but they had somebody else. And then they said, and Bernie Sanders, the only socialist in country. He's not a socialist. He's an independent. It's like the bias of the press. Oh, if you're in favor of, if you're opposed to cutting Medicaid, you must be a radical liberal. No, I'm sorry, you're one of 71% of Americans. That's called the mainstream. This is just incredible. Thinking about your general approach to issues, do you consider yourself to be liberal, moderate, or conservative? This I found very interesting. 35% of Americans called themselves conservative, 32% called themselves moderate, only 20% called themselves liberal, and yet 71% totally oppose cutting programs like federal student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps, and 67% oppose tax cuts for the wealthy. Yet they're calling themselves conservatives and moderates. Why? Because the word liberal has been so demonized by these guys. People don't know what it means. And I think it's time for liberals to take it back. We need to take back our titles here. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's on your mind today? Xavier? You got to be listening to your telephone, not your radio. And I think Xavier is listening to his radio. So we will go to Merrill in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Merrill.
Hello, Tom. One aspect of the anti-abortion issue is having an unlimited supply of
Merrill, I'm sorry, you're breaking up really bad. You must be calling on a cell phone, but your signal's falling apart. When you get in a better area, give us a call, or if you can get on a landline, give us a call. Let's go to Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott.
Good morning.
Scott, you're on a cell phone, too.
No.
You're not? You're gone. You're breaking up. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Gonzalez has got our phone lines. Let's try Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah, you've got a real phone line.
Actually, I'm on a cellular phone.
Oh, jeez. Okay, so there goes my theory. What's up, Steve?
You were mentioning about particle entanglement. One of the other implications of that is teleportation.
You're right.
And one of the other things, I was wondering how the fact that Angela Merkel, has been appointed Chancellor of Germany is going to affect both the United States and Europe.
Well, because it's such a compromise right now in Germany, frankly, I don't think it's going to have a huge effect. But what you're seeing is an incremental creep. And it really started back in the 80s when I was living in Germany in 86, 87. It started before that, actually, when the Brandt government went away. Basically, this turn to the right, a turn toward conservative, turn toward corporatist policies in Germany, which is the largest economy in Europe by far. And most of the rest of Europe, and Margaret Thatcher had a lot to do with that, oddly enough. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I said, hold it, Doc, the World War passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad, the boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, your dream.
Yeah, tell me about it. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It could kill a billion people worldwide, make ghost towns out of parts of major cities, and there's not enough medicine to fight it. Am I right? Reading from some alarmist rag, something from, you know, wacky news, something from the National Enquirer? No, it's ABC News. It could kill a billion people worldwide, make ghost towns out of parts of major cities. There's not enough medicine to fight it. It's the avian flu, of course. ABC News says it could be like having a Category 5 viral hurricane hit every single state simultaneously. In response to this threat to the United States of America, George W. Bush has appointed an Assistant Secretary for Public Health Emergency Preparedness. This is the guy who is responsible for dealing, well, he's, to quote ABC News, he is the point man for just about every health emergency that may hit our shores, ranging from anthrax attacks to an avian flu pandemic, end quote. His name's Stuart Simonson. And Stuart Simonson, the Bush administration's appointee, to protect us from the bird flu. Does he have a background in flu? No. How about medicine? No. Well, how about public health? No. How about disaster preparedness? No. Sorry. Bioterrorism preparedness? Did he maybe when he was 15 years old during the Cold War, he ran a bomb shelter in his local town? I mean, anything? No. His chief accomplishment seems to be, as they note over at thinkprogress.org, that from 1995 to 1999, he was Tommy Thompson's lawyer. He's a good Republican lawyer. Just like Michael Brown was. Michael Brown, another good Republican lawyer. They put him in charge of FEMA. They put Simonson in charge of the bird flu. Tommy Thompson, of course, used to be the Health and Human Services Secretary. Although when Thompson was in charge of Health and Services, Simonson apparently specialized in crime and prison policy. Now he's responsible for dealing with the potential of a bird flu epidemic. Does that mean that his plan is to put us all in prison? Or is he going to prosecute the flu? Maybe he's going to sue them. But wait a minute, you've got tort reform. You can't sue any longer. I'm telling you, friends, it is getting downright strange. Speaking of, you know, strange actions at a remote distance, what was that, the phrase from Albert Einstein? We got strange actions in Washington, D.C. Scott in San Diego, California, on the line. Our number 1-866-440-THOM. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call again. I was on an internet phone, and when my network stalled, so did the phone.
Oh, okay. Well, glad to have you back. What's up?
Thank you. I think mankind, as unconsciously, we've already spoken about abortion. Let me run through it really quickly. That article in the Wall Street Journal today reflects work that Carl Jung has done some time ago in synchronicity. If you take a shadow of a hawk, pass it between a light and a bunch of chicks that have just been hatched down below, the chicks will immediately run for cover. They won't, however, if you flash the shadow of a pigeon over them. Why? Who taught them? What he means is that we have a common dream, that we circulate all our dreams. Our artistic creativity is actually the unconscious mind expressing itself. And we already have. The painting on the Sistine Chapel shows Adam fully formed when God touches him and breathes life into him. So therefore, I think unconsciously as humankind, we've expressed our views about abortion already. Life begins when we are born or we take our first breath.
Well, that's certainly the biblical view. I mean, it's the word inspiration comes from, and inspire come from the word, I believe it's Latin, maybe Greek word for breath, which is spire.
It stems from Sanskrit.
Sanskrit,
it's a very
interesting
word, yes.
Okay.
It stems out of Sanskrit and proceeds to there. It literally means God inside.
Right.
In
right.
Spirit. And just as a quick note to get to a more funny thing, the avian flu has been found in Turkey.
Has been found in turkeys. Yeah, I know. But it has not yet mutated to the point where it can transmit itself from humans to humans. I saw the headline today that they're calling that they found turkeys. Yeah.
That's kind of funny, don't you think? Avian flu found in Turkey?
Okay. All right. I'll give you that, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Molly in Monterey, California. Hey, Molly.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for listening on KRXA.
You bet. Just about a couple things about word games, that liberal is a very, very bad word unless it's paired with capitalism or democracy, which is code for corporate rule in what I'm seeing anyway.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although, you know, the first president of the United States to call himself a liberal was George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
it's got a mighty tradition.
It does. It really does. And it started with Rousseau and John Locke and the whole, you know, the whole Enlightenment thing. And the idea of the Declaration of Independence was a liberal idea. The idea of a nation, a representative, constitutionally limited Republican democracy was a liberal idea. The conservatives wanted kings. And I think they still do. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
The polar caps are melting at a rapid pace. And rising ocean levels soon could harm the human race. But they have got no proof their theories are correct. Our corporations don't get.
Slash
another little piece of the
Ah, just slash it.
Burn it.
Burn another little piece of Brazil. It feels so good.
Oh, burn it down.
Cut it.
Cut another little piece of the forest down, baby.
Ah, you know you like it. There's plenty of wood. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the program where reason is our lifestyle choice, where we run rings around the right wing every single day of the week to the extent that that can be done. Rick Bloom is with us. It's our best of the rest of the news segment. We'd like to wrap up the week by getting a couple of commentators on from the blogosphere, the alternative media, sometimes even the so-called mainstream media. But really, I want the folks who are out there on the cutting edge, who are really seeing what's happening, hearing what's happening, have their ear to the ground, their eyes out, getting a good, strong sense of what's going on in the world. Rick Bloom is with us. He coordinates the OpenTheGovernment.org website, a broad coalition of journalists and free speech environmentalists that advocates fighting the expansion of government as secrecy. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. And we have Gonzo Schechsnyder?
Schechsnyder.
Schechsnyder. Thank you, Gonzo. I'm not sure I ever said your name out loud before, your last name. Gonzo and I go way back here. The managing editor of BuzzFlash.com, one of the finest news sites out there on the whole of the Internet. Be sure to check out BuzzFlash.com. And I'm just very pleased to have both of you with us. Gonzo, let me start with you. What do you see as, here we are at the end of the week, what do you see as really the, not necessarily the biggest, splashiest, sexiest, it bleeds, it leads kind of story. But what do you see as the story that came out of this week that, you know, 6 months, a year from now, 10 years from now, we'll be looking back going, wow, that was something.
Huh. You know, kind of a toss-up because I still think we don't know what's going to happen from the fourth time that Roe has gone in front of the grand jury to testify. He was there today. So we don't really know what's going to happen. It could have huge, you know, consequences for down the year from now.
Yeah, this could be a Watergate kind of event,
yeah, I mean,
especially if Roe rolls over and turns in George W. Bush, for example.
Yeah, big stuff. But I think yesterday, the photo op, the fact that so many news sources, AP, you know, from the pool wire, that sort of exposing the propaganda of the administration. And I think that's the kind of stuff that eats away at traditional supporters. When they see stuff like that, they may not necessarily quickly believe it, but I think it sort of, chews away at their support as slowly and sort of takes away his credibility.
Yeah, you know, I was quite impressed by that. I saw first Keith Olbermann's program Countdown. You know, which is Keith is pretty good. I mean, I wouldn't characterize him as a liberal, but he's a damn good journalist, and
yeah.
and he reports the news straight up, and he reports a lot of news that nobody else reports in television.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it on Countdown, and I thought, oh, that's great. You know, Keith did a great job. I'm not going to see that anywhere else. And then I forget which network it was that we flipped to. I think it was ABC, and they led with the same thing. It was like one of the network news stations was, here's the story behind the story. And I was just, what? You know,
yeah.
I'm seeing this on network television.
Maybe they're finally tired of being burned, you know, maybe.
Yeah, or they're finally tired of being treated like, a good metaphor that's not obscene doesn't come to mind.
School children?
Yeah, that's, you know, yeah, being patronized. Actually, I think that they're tired of being threatened. Because that's what this administration has been doing with the news media. They either vilify them or they threaten them, and they're getting some pushback. Good point, Gonzo.
I think they're also getting. This administration has such a reputation for being secretive, and also for misusing science and misusing information, and for tweaking information for their own political purposes. And it might have been Katrina. It might have been the EPA saying that it's safe to breathe the air after 9/11. But, you know, the press was ready to jump when they had the opportunity. And I think that they're increasingly becoming ready to jump on this.
Speaking of secrecy, Rick Bloom, Bloom, right?
Yes.
Rick Bloom, this is your specialty. What do you see as the big story of the past week?
Well, you know, I think that it'll be very interesting what happens with this Karl Rove, his testimony, and whether there are indictments, and how that all plays out, because this could have, you know, the flip side of what's happening here is that this could have tremendous impacts for whistleblowers in the government. You know, and this past week, the Supreme Court heard a case about an L.A. Police officer who had lied about a drug arrest, and the or at least according to the news accounts. And the attorney that was covering the case said that, and he was asked to tone down his assessment. And so he wrote that there was, that the police officer clearly was misleading. And now that lawyer is suing, trying to assert his First Amendment rights after he was reprimanded.
Interesting.
So I think that, you know, right now whistleblowers are under incredible attack, and it'll be really interesting to see whether Karl Rove or anybody else in the White House is indicted, either under the same statute that Daniel Ellsberg was attacked for, or whether it's something else. Because this case could really, really send a very interesting message to whistleblowers and have interesting impacts there.
Rick Blum, what is the status right now of federally protected whistleblowers? I recall doing a news story sometime in the last year or so about a change in the federal status that whistleblowers have, but I don't recall, frankly, if it was a law, if it was a change in policy, if it was simply the Bush administration ignoring the law, what the deal was. Where do whistleblowers stand now, both governmental whistleblowers, federal or state, and corporate whistleblowers?
Well, you know, basically, the whistleblowers have no protections. There was a Whistleblower Protection Act that had been eroded by the courts for a number of years, and there are administrative avenues that whistleblowers can take if they have a problem and they want to appeal to it. But those are largely ineffective, and even the courts are ignoring whistleblowers. There's this former FBI contract linguist, Sibel Edmonds, who was raising problems with the translations that the FBI was doing in their intelligence inquiries, especially before and after 9/11. Well, she was fired, and the Inspector General of the Justice Department said that she was fired largely because of the allegations that she was trying to make, and that the government didn't look into her her allegations very seriously. Well, the government said, well, this entire case is a state secret, and we can't reveal anything even to the courts, and so this case ought to be thrown out of the courts. Right now, her case is thrown out of courts, and she's appealing to the Supreme Court. And this last week, the court heard arguments or took written arguments in that case. So right now, whistleblowers don't have much to stand on, and Congress is considering moving this. There's a couple pieces of legislation that would help in a variety of ways. But largely, you know, if you're somebody who knows that there's something wrong going on in government, you know, it's best to keep quiet.
you're in deep trouble, is the bottom line.
You're in deep trouble.
Yeah. So, Rick, what do you see as the big stories coming up over the next week? Very quickly. We've only got a couple minutes left here.
Well, I think, you know, after all this controversy around the Katrina contracts, there's a growing criticism that the public can't see these contracts, that bloggers can't see these contracts. So I think that hopefully we're going to see, I can tell you what we should see. We should see for more calls for these contracts to be publicly available, for the government to put these things online.
Right.
And I think that's something that folks haven't really covered very much, but it's a growing, interesting development.
You hope to see that in the news. Gonzo, what's your take on, BuzzFlash.com, what's your take on what's coming up down the road here over the next week or so?
Oh, down the road. I have a feeling that with the Saddam's trial, that's going to, hopefully they're not going to take that and use that in some way to prop up Bush or to make him seem like he's more effective.
How could they resist?
Well, I know they're going to try, but I hope the media sticks to their uncovering the propaganda mode a little bit next week.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one, because if Saddam actually is allowed to make a defense, part of his defense is going to be that he was brought to power by Bush number one, the Reagan, you know, in part he was supported by Bush and Reagan. You know, the conservatives supported him way back when, in the 50s, you know, when, was it Mossadegh? Or am I mixing up my countries here?
I'm not sure, but they could bring out that photo of him shaking hands with Donald Rumsfeld. I mean,
right. Yeah. There's all kinds of potential embarrassments for the administration, and my guess was that's why they've been delaying the trial. But I know that the Republicans are also chomping at the bit to have a trial so that they can roll out pictures of, you know, gassed children up in Kurdistan and look at this.
That they may have actually done anything, you know, with the war on terror other than kill 2,000 American soldiers, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Bush desperately is in need of support for the war on terror. This is why he's doing these silly photo op things.
It's really all he's got left, I think.
Badly staged photo ops. What Gonzo, in your mind? I know BuzzFlash.com covers the news. You know, it's a news site, a good solid news site. And by the way, I really like the little feature you've got where you can look at, you know, the last hour, the last 3 hours, that kind of thing, the two hours.
Oh, great. Yeah.
What do you think is the one of the biggest stories that is not being covered by the mainstream media that people should be looking for when they go to BuzzFlash? We have a little less than a minute, by the way.
I'm guessing just the significance of the approval ratings, as they, you know, everything he's tried so far has done nothing to affect them, and they keep getting lower and lower and lower, and every time they put out a story on it, it's always like he's hit a new low, and it's like, at what point do we quit giving him political capital? You know, quit giving, saying, this guy's got his lay rating so low, why do we even consider his Supreme Court nominee?
Right. When does he fall off the edge?
Right.
Gonzo with BuzzFlash.com, Rick Bloom with OpenTheGovernment.org. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot.
I appreciate it from both of you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
Believe it.
Who's mad? Tiananmen Square.
Trust it.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
Yep, it's coming.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And if it's going to happen, my friends, it's going to be you and me that are going to make it happen. Take back this country from the theocrats and the oligarchs and the kleptocrats and turn it back into the hands of we the people. Restore democracy in this great country. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM. Trish in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Trish, thanks for calling.
Hi, I love your show.
Well, thank you.
You do a great job and you're so well informed and you have great guests.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother died from an illegal abortion when my mother was 10. She left 6 children behind, and the youngest were twins that were 11 months old.
Oh, my.
The family was split up when she died. And my point is that making abortions illegal again does not stop abortions. It just means women die.
That's right, and it always has. And what's amazing is that throughout history, abortion has not only been legal, but you know the Catholic Church had no problem with it. In fact, in their medical teachings, they taught how to do abortions, and the herbs for abortions were well known. The abortifacient herbs, things like tansy and rue, and others. And you know, every society, every culture has always had this. But it was in the 19th century when the Protestant populations were starting to grow really substantially after the Catholics lost the war with Italy and the Catholic lands were taken back by Italy, that the Catholic Church was looking around going, hey, wait a minute, we need more Catholic babies here. And so they outlawed abortion for Catholics.
Wow.
And that's really when it all began. Abortion was legal even within the Catholic Church up until about 150 years ago. And the word abortion does not appear in the Bible. You know, in fact, you know, biblically, there are several different places in the Bible where it's very clear that the intent of the writers or author or however you want to characterize it, whether you're a literalist or not, is that life begins when the first breath is taken. That, you know, in fact, in Genesis, you know, God formed Adam and breathed life into his nostrils. It's right, you know, it's right there from the very beginning. So it's what a tangled web. You know, we weave with all this stuff, and I'm very sorry to hear about your grandmother's. I said I had she wasn't so much a friend. It was a woman, you know, a girl in my class when I was in high school who, you know, I knew. I didn't know her particularly well, but, you know, one day she just wasn't there, and word spread. She had died from an infection that she got from an illegal abortion, because this was 1966, 67.
Yeah, I'm about your same age, and I remember that time, too, and... You know, my mother was 10 years old and had to watch her mother bleed to death.
Yeah.
It's just a horrible thing.
It really and truly is. Trish, thank you for calling.
And thanks for having that issue on your show.
You're welcome. We'll come back to it from time to time.
Right.
It is an important issue, and thank you very much. Sandra in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Tom. Listen, your show is so informative, but I just want to get back to the issue woman was talking about, the abortion.
Okay.
How you mentioned that to that woman lawyer from Republican, whatever, that you had asked people over and over what would be the penalty, and this is what gives me nightmares at night. Are we going to have, prisons full of women and doctors who had abortions or attempted to? I mean, they seem to have no practical response to that question. It's a really good one because I'm confused. I'm like, I'm 40, so I grew up when it was always available, and I'm thinking, wow, now what? You know?
Yeah, well, this is what the Democrats need to be saying, or at least, let's say, this is what pro-choice Democrats and Republicans need to be saying in the media, in the press right now, is they need to be saying, if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade and abortion becomes criminalized, what will be the criminal penalties to the women and to the doctors who participate in it? And start that debate going. Because once that debate starts going, then it suddenly gets real to Americans. We're talking about criminalizing something that's been legal for 30 years.
That's what I'm saying. And it's like I never hear that discussion. It's all abstract. But the reality is, what, you're going to have women bleeding and dying and then going to jail? I mean, I really appreciate you bringing it up. I am so grateful, and, have a nice weekend.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it. Here's another example, kind of in the same category. An Army veteran who fled to Canada to avoid prosecution for growing marijuana to treat his chronic pain was taken from a hospital, driven to the U.S. border with a catheter still attached, and turned over to federal officials. Stephen W. Tuck went 5 days with no medical treatment and only ibuprofen for the pain. 38 years old, still fitted with a urinary catheter as he was shuffled into federal court. He was taking medical marijuana in California, a state where the state declared it was legal. And the feds came in and said that they were going to throw him in prison. He fled to Canada to avoid prosecution. Canada said, sorry, we don't have legal marijuana here, so we can't protect you. He turned him over to the feds. The guy's in prison with a catheter, with no access to painkillers. The state had said it's legal, but the federal government, see, this is the conservative morality is about what you do in your private life, what you do in your bedroom, what you do in your living room, what drugs you're taking, who you're sleeping with, whether or not you're going to have an abortion. That's conservative morality. Progressive morality, real, true American historic morality is, do we have hungry people among us? Do we have homeless people among us? Do we have those among us who are uneducated, who are unwell? Do we have people in prison who need to be visited or who maybe shouldn't even be in prison? The classic morality of America, the traditional America, morality of America, is also the morality of the world's great religions, and we need to take it back. Annie in Olympia, Washington. Annie, I'm sorry, we're just out of time. You can say hi.
Hi there.
But thanks for being with us. Annie, give us a call back next week. I'll put you on the air, I promise. Thanks to Louise and David Poole for producing our program. Shelby and Ben for streaming it on RadioPower.org and White Rose Society. Stan and Dan at Air America Radio for all their help. Mike Toth for his archives. Sue and the folks in the chat room, our affiliates, our advertisers. And special thanks to you for listening. Without you, we don't have a program. I am so grateful that you listened to our program this week. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. Keep well. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.